Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll be talking with Utah author Gabriel Tallent. He's the author previously of the New York Times best-selling novel My Absolute Darling. His new novel is called Crux. Here's the plot in brief. Dan and Tama are two teenagers in their last year of high school in the southern Mojave Desert. One is a gifted golden child, the other a mouthy burnout. Climbing boulders in trash-strewn parking lots during cold desert nights, they seal their unique bond and dream of a life of adventure. Gabriel Tallent was born in New Mexico and raised on the Mendocino Coast by two mothers. He received his BA from Willamette University in 2010, and after graduation spent two seasons leading youth trail crews in the backcountry of the Pacific Northwest. Tallent lives in Salt Lake City. Gabriel Tallent, thanks for coming on our program.
Oh, thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
So you grew up in California, I believe.
Yeah, Mendocino, California. So not exactly the California that you imagine, kind of a colder, rockier, rainier California, foggy.
Right. And not the setting for this new book either.
New book is set in sort of the Inland Empire, so east of Los Angeles, closer to Joshua Tree National Park in the southern Mojave Desert.
Yeah. So what brought you out to Utah then?
My wife.
Your wife. Okay.
Yeah, great. Yeah. We met in college. She grew up here in Salt Lake, and I was from Northern California. We met in Salem, Oregon, at Willamette University at the library, and hit it off. And I was a little skeptical of following her out to Salt Lake, but did after college and fell in love with it immediately.
Yeah.
I came here after she graduated, so in like 2011, and we went out the next day to our friendly local gear shop and bought a rack of gear from Shingo, who's still there, and at IME, and just started climbing at Storm Mountain and had a just like, yeah, fell in love, as I said.
Yeah, well, that's great. So this new book followed. Maybe we could start with the main characters, Dan Redbird and Tama Callahan, best friends. They've just started their senior year of high school, and part of the kind of the ritual of their friendship is rock climbing.
They sneak out their bedroom windows at night to go climb rocks in a deserted parking lot. Yeah,
yeah. They don't go on the weekend because it's kind of a shady place on the weekend.
Yeah. Yes. That's you've got it correct. So it kind of forces them to climb at night when it's cold and miserable.
Yeah. So I wonder, before we go on with the characters, did you have rock climbing in mind for you know, as a main plot point of your new book as you were thinking about this, or did you get into rock climbing and that became part of it?
Ooh, I'm not sure I entirely understand the question. So I've been climbing since coming to Utah.
Okay.
Fell in love with the sport. Really wanted to figure out a way to write a novel about it. A novel, because the sort of the magic and the possibility and the excitement of climbing can be, like many physical sports, like dancing, a little hard to capture on the page. And I think people are skeptical of climbing, I mean, for good reason, but a lot of climbing stories can sort of sound a little bit like a person enchanted with risk, takes a risk, almost dies, doesn't die. And it can be like a little hard to drive the excitement in that structure. The experience of climbing can be a little elusive on the page, and I really wanted to chase down a way to capture my experience of it, and it took me a little while. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Okay, terrific.
So how did you overcome those difficulties? Difficult getting, because I think you really nailed it on the page. I've never been rock climbing. You took me there. How did you overcome some of those difficulties describing it?
Generous of you. That's so generous of you. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I wrote a lot of books that didn't work. I tried to write a lot of climbing books that I ended up throwing away because they didn't make it real for the reader. And I think a couple things happened. I kept climbing and kept having experiences and thinking a lot about them. And my son was born, Hayden was born, And we had a kind of a touch and go pregnancy. And after he was born, I was holding him and I was thinking a lot about what I would tell him matters in a life. And I realized that I hadn't put what I really believed into the book. I'd sort of been writing the book as if climbing and prestige and climbing accomplishments matters, but that's not really what I felt was true, and that I'm a terrible climber. So neither is it my experience of climbing, that it matters because you're doing it at the highest echelons of the sport. And so I rewrote it thinking a lot about that, about how climbing mattered in my life, that it wasn't necessarily the big things, it was the small things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Am I getting across?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
terrific.
For sure. I was watching a brief interview you gave. You were in the shadow of a big boulder. You were just after a climb or about to go on a climb, and you were talking about the writing process and climbing, etc.
Yeah.
And you talked a little bit about that you just got to write. You got to write, and maybe you'll discard a book or two until you get to the one you're land on.
Yeah, I guess I don't remember that interview, but I would stand by it. And I do think you have to take wild risks in writing. And so to a certain extent, you just have to keep trying, even if it seems impossible. If you want to do it, maybe you should stop writing altogether. Maybe that's the smartest way to do it. Find another job. But if you do want to write a book, I think you have to spend a lot of time writing. I think it's kind of like running. You know, you're a runner if you run. You're a writer if you write.
Yeah. So once again, teenage characters here. Your previous book, My Absolute Darling, Turtle, fascinating character, 14 years old, I think.
Yeah.
In her case, complex character and really hard theme there, right? Sexual abuse included, and her father, very complex character. Once again, some teenage characters here. I guess on the surface, you would just tell me, well, a writer writes, right? But I'm fascinated by how you.
No, I'm just writing on a 20-year delay.
Yeah. 20-year delay.
They'll get
you,
older.
You
with
have
every book.
Been. You were a teenager, right?
Yeah.
So is that what you're? That's what you're drawing on?
I think I'm writing on a little bit of a delay. I wrote a book about a 29-year-old. Cardiothoracic nurse that my editor didn't work. I've tried other ages in books. My next project is about a 26-year-old wildland firefighter. So we're working up there. I do admit that it has been two in a row about teenagers, and we're moving on next.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, you do it very well. It's fascinating, but it's that's an obvious question I had, is how do you get into that? I guess it's the same question. How do you get into any character, right? Because you can't just write your own lived experiences. I guess you could.
No, you mine your experiences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm so skeptical of writing narrowly autofiction, your own experiences, because while I am impressed by those books oftentimes, I'm not sure that we understand ourselves the best. Like, I'm not sure if the thing we know best in the world is ourselves. And I think people tend to lean on that, right? Like, we want people to write from personal experience. But I'm not sure our entire interiority is illumined to us. And so I don't know that we should take ourselves only as subjects.
Yeah, yeah, very true. Well, tell me a little bit more about Dan Redburn and Tama Callahan. Best friends, it's a platonic relationship. She's lesbian, I think, and there's another contrast. He's a straight A student, and she's kind of indifferent to school.
Yeah, you're nailing it. She's sort of a burnout. She's like a mouthy stoner who is ravaged with learning disorders and despised by her teachers and not well liked by her peers because she's bratty and insouciant. And Dan is, and she's sort of, she's homely and weird and a spaz. And Dan, in contrast, is a kind of a graceful, forceful personality. The deceptiveness is, I think, that the zaniness of Tama's personality is, when you are inside it on the page, very charming, which, I think is like a little authorial sleight of hand. It makes her more likable than she might really be if you knew this enormously talkative person. And Dan, in contrast, is tall and strong, extremely intelligent and in kind of a steadier and more analytic way. Tama is not regarded by her teachers as smart. I would argue that she has a kind of intelligence that is not shining in school, which is how I felt in school. But Dan has a sort of a classic straight A student brightness to him. He's a reader, he's charming, he's disciplined, he does his homework, he shows up. So they are very different people, united by the tremendous affection they share for each other.
It's interesting that I guess the very first chapter, you get a sense of how they feel about each other. Dan attempts a climb. He's not up so high, but high enough to be kind of dangerous. And I should note, they can't afford equipment. They don't take equipment. And then he falls. And they say, well, it would have been nice if we'd had a pad. Right? But instead, I guess Tama tries to catch him. And
Yeah,
then
she
and
tries
you
to
can
catch
tell
him.
she's really distressed by what almost happened.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think something that I really wanted to chase, you let me know if I'm answering your question here. Something I really wanted to chase in this is the feeling of having a dream, right? When Dan and Tama are out climbing, they're having an experience of meaning, of the numinous that's missing in the rest of their lives, and they want to chase it. But they can't afford equipment. They don't have the support of their parents. They don't have access to mentors. They don't have the money or the time or the resources to do this safely. So they're going out on their own, trying to figure it out, doing it in the worst and most dangerous way possible, which is, I think, the experience of many people chasing a dream when you don't have resources. And so I wanted to like lean into this idea of like, how do you pursue a vocation when the stakes are high? When you don't clearly have access, because they're kind of two working class kids who don't have everything they need and they don't have a lot of safety in life. And if they wanted to pursue sort of steadiness and stability, they would work and get jobs. So this dream of being a climber, of being climbers that they share together, is totally madcap. And it's not clear how it would pan out. And I love that because that is how I think dreams oftentimes feel. Like they feel insecure, they feel terrifying, they involve risk.
Yeah, well said. You could say this is sort of how teenagers think, right? But I think maybe everybody with a dream, everyone with a dream has, you got to take that same risk, right? And leap. And it may not work out, right? Maybe totally unrealistic, but you keep going, right? Even if
Yeah,
you're older.
I think, I mean, oftentimes it's not going to. I think as Americans, sometimes we slide into this very easy cultural narrative that is not reflected in our lives, that you should just chase your dreams. Like that is a common theme in stories. And I think the situation is so much more complicated because these kids don't have health care, they don't have money, they don't have jobs. Like if they flub it, they're going to end up nowhere. And that scariness, I think, adds tremendously to the stakes of the decision. But there's another risk as well, which is that a life in which you never chase dreams leaves a lot on the table. You can find yourself hedged into an experience, into a position in your life that where you've achieved none of the things you wanted, where you never chased it. And so what we tend to think of risk as something you take on, and as if you just made the safe choice the safe decision at every juncture, you sort of involve no risk, you escape risk. It's not true. You can lose a great deal that way. And sometimes it's worth it, right, to commit towards your dreams just so that your life has them, because never having done it is a terrible loss.
Yeah,
Is
certainly
that
true.
does that make
Cer
sense at all?
yes, certainly true. Certainly true. One thing that these teenagers are dealing with, I think it was a lot of young people deal with, is fears that they're going to turn into their parents. Certainly, I think of Tama's case, right?
Yes,
If I
and
don't, if I
Dan's.
don't,
Yeah,
if
you're
I don't,
nailing it.
if I don't get out of here, I'm going to turn into my parents, and then that's not the life I want.
Yeah, exactly. And in different ways, Tama is her Tama's mom is suffers a lot of financial insecurity and is sort of bitter and hostile and worn down by her life and stuck in these jobs she doesn't want. And Tama, who doesn't succeed at school, who has no opportunities, thinks that if she's not able to escape her circumstances, that is exactly how she's going to end up. And Dan's mother is sort of locked in her room in a perpetual depression from which she can't escape. Mm-hmm. And Dan himself is undergoing the onset of major mental illness. And so he can feel it chasing him, that if he doesn't find a solve, if he doesn't find some aliveness, if he doesn't find some source of inspiration, he's going to end up just like that, locked in his room.
You're listening to Access Utah. And we're talking with Utah author Gabriel Talent. His latest book's a novel called Crux. I want to mention here, before we go to a break, a couple of events. You can go and see Gabriel Talent coming up. He'll be at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City this coming Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. Then he'll be at the Printed Garden in Sandy on Friday, January 30th at 7 p.m. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour today is Utah author Gabriel Talent. His previous book is New York Times bestselling novel, My Absolute Darling, and he's out with a new novel. It's called Crux. So tell me about, I'm fascinated by the rock climbing terminology you use. A lot of it unfamiliar to me, right?
But the hope is you can catch it.
I do.
Okay.
For example, early in the book, I mentioned that Dan falls. The word they use is off. He was off.
He was off.
Which I took to mean he's off the rock.
He's off the rock.
There's nowhere else to go but to fall, right?
Yeah.
A lot of this is metaphor as well. He uses metaphor. For example, title of the book, Crux. What, tell me what that is. That's a rock climbing term.
I mean, it is a rock climbing term and a sort of term in ordinary parlance. So rock climbing, the crux is oftentimes the most difficult and consequential moment of a climb. The climb, the point oftentimes at which you succeed or fail. And so it's used in that sense here, but also as a major juncture, a crossroads in your life at which you go one direction or another, because both characters are facing major decisions, the cruxes of their lives, the cruxes of particular climbs.
Yeah. Apparently, I don't know if I got this right. Sending means you completed. You sent the climb. Yeah.
You sent it. Yeah.
Yeah. I love this terminology. I also love that you illustrate the way that these two teenagers show affection for each other. They kind of diss each other, right?
They're sassy.
They're sassy to each other.
They josh each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes in profane ways, right? This is the way some teenagers talk.
Is that not how your friends talk? Yeah, it's not how my friends talk.
Not how my friends talk, but I'm sure there are many teenagers who talk that way,
different crowds.
Yeah.
Oh, man. My old friends talk that way. Uh-huh. Sometimes the old guys are the worst for taking the piss out of you.
Yeah. So I'm guessing, I guess I want to know where you got some of this. You got from your friendships, I guess, right?
I mean, this is just how people I know and love talk. It received the dialogue in the book received a lot of criticism from early readers as being sort of a little too joshing, a little too provocative in places, but this is truly my experience of climbing, which is that you're out at the crag and people are just outrageous. I think climbing attracts big personalities, and there's something about like being out there away from other people that I think can sort of bring out the most creative and risky in a conversation. So it's just my experience that you're out with climbers and they are saying these outrageous things. And it is, to me, the verbal playfulness that attends climbing is, to me, one of its great joys and part of the depth and richness of climbing culture. And I'm not saying there aren't, but I couldn't I couldn't find that reflected in books, people who were talking this way. I knew a lot of people who talk this way, who say these things. I'm around it all the time, but I couldn't point to it in a book. And so it seemed worthwhile to me, even though that I know, I know reviewers are just gonna make hay of like how much the word dude appears in the book, which is just like, yeah.
I know teenagers that did the word. A lot of teenagers I know is guys. Hey guys, whether you're male or female. Hey guys, you know it's
yeah.
But you can see the affection that these two people have for each other in that they're kind of dissing each other, rising each other playfully, right?
A lot of and they a lot rely of humor. On each other for their survival. So yeah. the friendship is close knit.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about rock climbing. You know, you got into it. Obviously, these characters are—that's part of their dreams. Tama, especially, she, you know, idolizes professional rock climbers, and that's definitely her dream. And part of this is they want to come to Utah, right?
Because it's my stomping ground in a place I know well. One of their dreams is to come out to Canyonlands and climb sandstone towers in the White Rim. They sort of see that as the pinnacle, and as Canyonlands and Indian Creek in particular as one of the last places where you can just like set up a tent and dirt bag that is just like live out of your vehicle, like nearly year round, climbing all the time, getting really strong and sort of subsisting on as little money as possible and maybe working a few seasonal jobs. That's their dream. They want to escape their families. They want to escape their circumstances and come out here to Utah and do that, climbing seriously and making themselves into formidable athletes.
Yeah. And a big part of this, I guess, is that's the dream. And what does that dream represent? It's, I guess it's freedom, right?
It's a vocation.
Else?
I mean, their climbing is they're making art, right? Like these are kids who are suffering, who have trauma, who feel trapped into lives that they don't want. And their experience, it's a twinned experience, right? Of friendship, which I think climbing in this way offers us. Obviously, you can be like a solo climber, you can be a boulder, you can do it alone. But the kind of climbing they're doing is together and is about community. So they have each other and they have this sport they're doing. Like each climb is this little sand painting dance with death, right? Like a performance of the improbable where they explore who they are. Right, so to them, it's art. It's meaningful. It's something they want to perfect and chase and do, like many athletes. Right, like they hanker after being athletes, and so it represents a dream that escapes them, that gets them away from a reality in which they see no aliveness. And they're looking at their parents, and their parents hate their lives. Their parents are trapped in jobs they don't like. They're suffering through untreated mental illness. There's sort of no world, no traditional world that they're seeing around them that calls to them, in which they can see themselves surviving. And so climbing is this sort of last desperate hope that they have for a life of meaning and adventure.
Juxtaposed to that dream, kind of the weightlessness of that dream is the heaviness of the current situation. They can see what their parents have turned into, but also the past, right? They're Dan and Tama's mothers used to be friends, now estranged, and you got a whole history there, which adds to that weight.
Yeah, I mean, I think many kids are looking at the lives of their parents and trying to mine lessons from it, and you want to do this in the book, right? Like their parents have these failed trajectories, which serve several purposes in the book, and one is just to complicate the story because Dan's mother, Alexandra, is a famous novelist, so someone who has likewise chased a vocation, but she ends up unhappy in the profession, failed, blocked, unhappy, depressed, and I think like part of the essential purpose of that is to complicate the trivial idea that all you need to do is chase your dreams and everything works out. You need more than that. Life is more than that. Like I have seen people, artists, chase monstrous ambitions to the exclusion of all else and end up unhappy and alone, getting the greatest accolades that you can get in a career and not savoring it. And so it looks to me like down that path lies madness, right? A sort of Ahabian emptiness and nihilism that you have to put there in the story to complicate a misreading of it that really easily occurs to American readers, I think. Does that make sense? And the other thing you want to do is you want to take the stakes, you want to make the stakes high. Like part of what you want to do as a writer for a reader is to put your characters under so much pressure that we can see every part of them, right? You want to rip them apart so that we see their guts. We see everything about them. And having the specter of their parents' failed lives does that. It raises the consequences of this decision so that there's tremendous urgency to get it right. And to get it right in a complicated and nuanced way because there's no simple answer. Was that a terrible answer,
That
or
was an
am I explaining it to you, or are you
yes, you are.
baffled?
That
Okay.
was I am not baffled. That was an excellent answer. Thank you.
The parents serve counterexamples to misreadings,
For
right?
sure.
Like you can't do it this way. You can't do it that, like you can't have no dreams and you can't have only dreams. Like part of why Alexandra ends up alone is because she abandons her friendships. It's an argument for the importance of other people in our lives, which is something that I hold to be fundamental.
Have to have some balance, right? And, but you really, reading the book, you really hope for these two young people, right? You really, that's a testament to your talent, right? And you've really defined these characters, and you have a kind of protective, at least I did as a reader, protective instinct, really hoping for them, right? That they get the balance right.
I hope so, but that's a question for you, not
That's
for me.
exactly, I want to talk about resilience. That's a theme that stood out to me, and my absolute darling in this one as well. Turtle, for example, my absolute darling, the very definition of resilience. She's trying to survive against almost impossible odds, it can seem sometimes. These two characters, a lot of difficulties in their lives, a lot of things piled up against them. And they're at least trying to be resilient. So I wonder what, in your mind, what makes people resilient, and some people are not. So what's the difference? What makes person resilient, do you think?
Oh man, what makes someone resilient? I mean, one of the reasons you're putting so much emphasis on the book is that I think like readers' lives, people's lives, you never know what's happening for them, right? And so sometimes readers will be coming to your book from hospital waiting rooms, from dark moments in their lives. Things will have gone wrong. Like you don't know. And so you want to take that seriously, that bad things happen in people's lives. I think if you're not taking that seriously in a book, you're not honoring the condition under which people might be reading your book, right? Like you're just ignoring darkness, and that doesn't make for real brightness.
Yeah, certainly.
I think for like real hope to be in their book, you also have to have real challenges. You have to show people facing down the kinds of problems that I think people face down in their lives. They come to dark junctures, and how do they persevere? And so you want to show that in the book as a way of respecting the reader. Like there's brightness in this book. It is supposed to be a romp. The characters are funny and hopeful. It is a quest to persevere. But commensurate with that is like, yes, hard things happen. You're not just reading about people in a fantasy land who never suffer setbacks. You're trying to write about real people because real people are reading your book. So that's why all the darkness. And then are some people resilient or not resilient? I think we can give everyone the tools to be resilient. I think we should try and lift each other up. I think we should try and help people through the dark times in their lives. And I would resist the idea that it's inborn or something you have or something you don't have. It's something you can learn, and it is something that you can sort of just keep doing. It is more something you do than something you, like, I don't want to, you know, like, the more you do it, the stronger you get. But you can come to really bad places in your life where you don't have a lot and you can start learning the skills. So I'm like, I'm so nervous about putting it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I totally agree. I don't think you're necessarily born with it. It's a skill you can use, and you use it during the bad times, right? That's when you build up the muscle.
Yeah, and I think hope is part of it.
Yeah.
Like believing in yourself, you know.
I want to quote you. You gave this quote in an interview, a previous interview. I think this was in response to an interview you were giving with my absolute darling. It goes to what you were just saying just a minute ago here. I think it encapsulated what you were just saying. You say, I think good books ask us to be courageous readers. And that's what you were getting at, right? Good books ask us to be courageous readers.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, to a certain extent, I was speaking to the difficult material in My Absolute Darling. And the material here is a lot less difficult. It's an easier book. But you're right. And I do think that we should be courageous, generous readers who, like, books show us other lives. And we should have a kind of receptiveness to that.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah author Gabriel Talent of More With Him following a break. Before we go to break, I want to mention a couple of events. You can go and hear Gabriel Talent reading his new book, Crux, at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City this coming Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. He'll also be at the Printed Garden in Sandy on Friday, January 30th at 7 p.m. We'll have more following a break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah author Gabriel Talent. He's authored previously of the New York Times bestselling novel, My Absolute Darling. His new novel is out. It's called Crux. You were, again, in this. This is a very brief interview, and I can't remember. I would tell you, this is the one you were sitting under a boulder or next to a boulder and just rock climbing. but they ask you about your next book. And you said, well, what are you up to? And you said, well, I'm doing a lot of rock climbing and I'm reading the Plants of the Wild or something. You're reading up on plants and
Woody
such.
Plants of Utah.
Woody Plants of Utah, right?
Yeah, that's a great
this
book.
Is,
I've been through like four copies of
really,
it.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're trying to get the setting right, you know, for some of these places. And I wonder how you go about effectively writing this world, right? For example, Joshua Tree. Area, this area in the Mojave Desert, some areas in Utah, you know, the places that you have Dan and Tama inhabit.
Yeah, how do you get it right?
How
I
do
mean,
you get it right? Yeah.
The nailing every plant name is just it's just an interest of mine. It is not a good writing tip. I love carrying around a book because it slows you down sometimes. Mm. Like you need to stop and look around you and make a study of the plant. So I like it as a way of experiencing the trails out here in Utah. And I like the feeling of knowing what is there. I now have three kids and they do not tolerate stopping and going through a dichotomous key to see what the plant is. So that was to a certain extent a feature of having a lot of time to really tramp around. But I think there's no right answer to how you bring a place alive. Like, you have to love a place and spend time there, and you try and tell the reader what it is you love about it. You try and put it on the page, like why you love it, without saying so and so in as many words. And then I think it begins to appear to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, this desert is just a place that my wife and I have gone every year to go climbing, and has to me like a special place as fundamental to our experiences of learning how to trad climb and of being dumb, reckless idiots together you know, I love it for that reason. That's why I wrote about it, and I try and make that come through in the text.
Yeah. So you go to, do you go to Southern Utah to do your climbing?
So we go to Joshua Tree.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
A little less now because, you know, we had the pandemic and then we had twins who had some health problems. Mm. And so there has been a hiatus in our climbing as we work to keep everyone alive. Everyone's doing great. Milo and Kobe are thriving. Harriet is still alive. But things got a little touch and go for a moment. So we slowed down on the adventures. Before that, previous to that, we were like Indian Creek, White Rim, City of Rocks, Joshua Tree, and Little Cottonwood Canyon, obviously, as our like major destinations and stomping grounds.
Mm-hmm. I guess where I'm going with that is you live in Salt Lake area, right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, some people say, hey, you can just go out to a park, you get all the full benefits of nature, and that's probably in part true, but to get what you get from rock climbing, I guess you can't just get somewhere in Salt Lake. You personally.
Oh, well,
you have to be out there on some rock in the desert. Or do you or not, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I think of Little Cottonwood Canyon as being part of Salt Lake.
Well, that's true. I totally forgot that you're
and I think
20 minutes away. Like, that's true.
The
yes.
Little Cottonwood, I mean, I'm, you know, I live in Mill Creek. Little Cottonwood Canyon is close for us, and I mean, in my heart, it is spectacular, world-class climbing.
Yeah.
The granite climbing in Little Cottonwood, like 5.9 minus in Little Cottonwood, spectacular grade. One of the hardest grades you'll ever climb. Demanding, technical. You can end up, you know, climbing some 5.8, 5.9 in Little Cottonwood and reappraising your whole life. I sort of learning how to trad climb, I learned in Little Cottonwood Canyon and in Joshua Tree, mostly in Little Cottonwood Canyon, and just love it. It's just spectacular.
Tell me again what
I don't think you have to go far away.
No. And I totally forgot about the canyons, which are 20. It's same for me and Logan. 20 minutes, I can be up the canyon.
I think you can also go to like Momentum and have mm-hmm. a blast pulling on plastic. It's not the same.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't offer the same sort of solitude and desperation and the feature of like climbing some crack with water leaking out of it covered mm-hmm. in wasps,
yeah,
which is something everyone should do at some point in life. but it does offer fun and challenge and excitement, and you know, and sometimes you can find someone else who's working the same problem and you can work it together mm-hmm. and, you know, and have an experience of camaraderie.
Yeah, for sure. And that's part of it, right? You said earlier in the hour, we need people, right? That's what Alexandra forgot, right?
I'm always trying to make climbing friends.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that now that I remembered the canyons, so they're so close, we're blessed in Utah, right? 20 minutes, you could be somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I came here and never left. I think it is one of the most fortunate places to be in the world. And you know, if Little Cottonwood isn't really good climbing, it's character building climbing.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
And I, you know, you love it in a hometown way. So yeah, I would stand by it as one of the luckiest backyard crags you could have almost anywhere.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Now you use the word trad climb. Define that again for me. What is trad climb?
Yeah, so sport climbing typically is climbing and clipping bolts that have been drilled into the rock. And so you know, it can be a gymnastic and very safer way. Not that it's not without dangers, but and then in trad climbing, you have a rack of gear that you bring up with you on your harness. And as you climb, you place your own gear and clip into it. And so It has a kind of an older school feel. It's a little slower. It requires you to pause and have the technical skills of placing and assessing gear. And it can have, doesn't always, but it can have this element of risk where you're trying to finagle gear that you're not entirely sure will hold. And it adds another dimension to it. To the experience. Does that make
Yeah, that
sense?
makes sense. Yeah. What do you read? What are you, I guess, either growing up and now, who do you read?
Yeah, so right now I put the kids to bed at 8, and then I go to bed and I read like 15 minutes of, right now I'm reading Agatha Christie. So I read
Okay,
15 minutes of Agatha Christie and then fall asleep, you know? So like I am not plowing through a lot of pages at this juncture in my life. But I read really widely. My roots are in a lot of like space opera, like swashbuckling sci-fi and fantasy novels, big fantasy series. And then, you know, I also got passionately into Melville in high school, and in college I got really into Thomas Hardy and made a big project of trying to read all the Hardy. And George Eliot is another person who's, so I read a lot of like, I read, you know, widely. And now I'm trying to work my way through the all of Philip Marlowe. I think I've done all of them, and I'm on the sort of the second reread of a lot of those books. But I have this like particular affection for The Long Goodbye, sort of the later Marlowe novels, when he's the books are a little slower, they're a little melancholy, there's a kind of you know, Marlowe is himself a little more beaten down, a little more hesitant, but still has a lot of humanity to him. So I read, I think, pretty widely. But I'm a slow reader. I think is a huge deficit that I have. I'm so slow.
I am as well. I just want to savor it. I guess that's one reason I, you know, go back and reread and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think for me it's like just dyslexia. I think I'm
Yeah.
just, you know,
Oh, I see. Just slow. Yeah.
I'm just not
Yeah.
as bright as
Right.
other readers.
I'm guessing that part's not true. We just have a couple minutes left here. I wonder about your process, how you get inspiration. I think from earlier comments, you would tell me you got to be writing. You got to be putting in the work. But maybe I'm
Okay,
taking words out of your mouth. Go ahead.
I think that that is true. I think you got to be writing. But like, I wrote failed versions of this book, right? And it was only after I stopped and took stock of what I really believed, because you can sort of get caught up in the storytelling and trying to tell the story almost as you think it should unfold. And that didn't work for me. So like, where you get inspiration, I think it comes from the most meaningful, the scariest, the most important, the most terrible junctures in your life. You go through like the crucible of some horrendous personal experience. And if you survive, you come out of it with some insight, something you would say to another person to make it easier if they were ever there, if they ever found themselves at that crossroads in their life. And you want to put that insight into fiction, but it's not a thing you can just tell someone, because if you just tell them, it's lost, it kills it, it's dead, right? You can't just tell someone, oh, you got to be tough and persevere. It means nothing. And so you try and put it in the story so that they get it, so that it makes it easier. You're trying to pass that on. And so I think that's where inspiration comes from our lives. And that sort of means that you have to be out there, that you can't just be locked away in a basement reading Melville or McCarthy and, you know, like you have to be having your own life and mining that.
Yeah, certainly true. Well said.
You give me a look of puzzlement. Is that, I'm worried it didn't make
No.
sense.
No. I was what you saw was me wondering how to phrase my last question here. I guess just kind of open-ended. What do you want people to take from from Crux.
I would like people to take a tremendous sense of hope and aliveness and inspiration. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with this book. I know that there are dark moments in the book, and I know that not everyone wants that in a book. I think it's necessary, but I am trying to write my way towards hope, because I have seen people lose the sense of hope, lose the sense of aliveness, lose the sense of possibility, become deadened to it, right? Like that happens to people in their, they lose their way. And I want to attack that. I want to leaven that. I think that there is hope here, even if we can't always put our finger on where it lies. And that is the story that I'm trying to tell, that things can be scary. We can feel overmatched. We can lose a little bit the trail, but we can find it again.
Very well said. Good place to end the conversation. The new book is out, Crux, getting rave reviews, and that is out, available to you. The author, Gabriel Talent, Utah-based writer, has been with us on Access Utah. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
Thanks for listening. Just a couple of brief mentions here at the end. The King's English Bookshop, Salt Lake City, this coming Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. Gabriel Town will be there. And the Printed Garden in Sandy on Friday, January 30th at 7 p.m. Another visit from Gabriel Town. Our thanks to him. Thanks to you for listening.
Skywatcher Leo T here, where it's one sky, many cultures, as we do a little space exploration from our own backyard, or the desert, or the ocean, or mountains, as we look and see that Jupiter is really big and bright right now, just past direct opposition a few days ago on the 10th. What does that mean? Well, opposition means the Earth is directly between Jupiter and the Sun. Jupiter is at its closest and brightest for the year and visible all night long, roaring in the east and revolving south as the night goes on. The giant of the planets is at the bottom of a hookshot with Castor and Pollux, which hang down perpendicular to our view from Earth. During opposition, Jupiter rises in the east when the sun sets in the west, reaches its highest point in the sky at midnight when the sun is below your feet, and sets in the west when the sun rises in the east. Wow, fun stuff. See the charts and photos on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page. That'll help it be a little more clear. But the wonders continue to dazzle over here as you look toward the south and see the three-star belt of Orion, which to me looks like the top of a kite, not some dude chasing a scorpion or being chased by a scorpion with a huge sword, but hey, it's all in the eye of the beholder, right? Nonetheless, whatever you like, if you're out there in the clear air and out of the city, you can make out the tail of the kite of the Orion Nebula in here. It's the second one down, and the magical Milky Way arches high over the Earth. And who knows what other treasures you will discover as you explore from your own planet. And another space exploration, good news for those of us excited to see the next NASA Artemis launch to the moon. NASA reporting January 9th that it plans to roll out the vehicle assembly building, or out of the vehicle assembly building, the Space Launch System rocket with the Orion spacecraft on top to famous Launch Complex 39B, no earlier than January 17th. The rollout is subject to technical readiness and weather conditions, of course. It's expected to take about 12 hours to creep out there. Artemis II, as we have been reporting, is the first crewed mission to go out to the moon since the Apollo missions of 1972. The four astronauts are excited to go, and NASA technicians have been working hard, some without pay, for the last few months. These scientists, technicians, and everyone involved are determined to see this successful launch. The launch has been evolving since the Artemis 1 uncrewed test mission to the moon. Artemis 2 and Orion space capsule will go out beyond the moon on a 10-day voyage to check out all of the systems. Once at the pad, the technicians will conduct a series of tests of the vehicle and ground systems to prepare for the final major milestone before launch. It's called a wet dress rehearsal. During that test, the rocket will be loaded with liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen propellants and will undergo a full practice countdown late January. The first launch period is amazingly soon, includes late evening launch windows on February 6th, 7th, and 8th, as well as the 10th and 11th, and a second launch period in March and April. So let's go, Artemis, to the moon. And riding from a view of Earth from 250 miles above, orbital author Samantha Harvey relates what it's like to be an astronaut on board the International Space Station. I highly recommend this book, the thoughts that run through their heads, including some riveting facts about the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft that are now an incredible 14 plus billion miles out from Earth, heading out into the void known as interstellar space. Her writing here has inspired me to interpret and add some additions from confirmed sources. Progressing past the heliosphere into interstellar space are two contraptions known as Voyager 1 and 2, great coffee grinders wimbling into wayless dark. High gain antenna, magnetometers, hydrazine thrusters, cosmic ray yawing, pitching way out here, 14 billion miles away from Earth towards eternity. And on each Voyager is a golden disc that is a gold-plated copper record filled with sounds of Earth, a record of the rhythm and blues, and so much more. One day in the next 500 billion years, after a full circuit of the Milky Way, maybe someone or something will encounter the spaceships and lower the stylus and fire it up and hear the da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da of Beethoven's Fifth rolling like thunder through a different frontier. Human music will permeate the Milky Way's outer reaches. There'll be Chuck Berry and Bach, Stravinsky and Blind Willie Johnson, and the didgeridoo, violin, slide guitar, and so much more. Music from around the world, bird song, tides rolling in, whale song, or adrift to the stars and nebula. Perhaps a being on a planet of a distant star will hear a recording of a sheep bleat, laughter, greetings in 55 languages, or the voice of a child. And more whale sounds, please. If you got to represent the Earth, let's use a whale. Carl Sagan, who is the lead scientist on these, noted that the spacecraft will be encountered and the record played only if there are advanced space-faring civilizations in interstellar space. But the launching of this bottle into the cosmic ocean says something very hopeful about life on this planet. Thank you, Carl. So keep the hope, keep looking up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.